This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. In the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
We also have, filling in for Brent Noctegal, Joshua Taylor.
Hello, and good to be here.
And from a field office in Alberta, Canada, we have Richard Palmer.
Good morning.
The hostage crisis in Afghanistan continues. To learn about the latest, what is happening over there, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
The situation in Afghanistan is shaping up to be one of the worst hostage crises in American history, and the Biden administration is being deliberately dishonest about it. It was only on Tuesday that the White House secretary announced that there were almost 100 Americans trapped in Afghanistan. And just a couple days later, the Taliban came out and announced that they were allowing 200 Americans from the Kabul airport to return home. So right there, you know that their White House was only telling us about half the number of Americans just in Kabul. And those 200 Americans that the Taliban has so graciously and benevolently decided to leave are not the only ones there. There's actually pretty reliable estimates from some congressmen that there's up to 500 Americans in Afghanistan who can't get out, or at least I guess now 300 of those can't get out. Probably some of the most high profile ones that you should be hearing about on every news network, and you're not, are 143 Americans trapped in the Mazar-i-Sharif airport. These 143 people, they're actually were loaded onto six different planes run by a Christian charity organized by the conservative talk show host here in America, Glenn Beck, and he went over there, and he was mainly looking at getting American Christians or American Christians or Afghan Christians with a green card out of the country. Had them loaded up on six planes, was ready to take off when a directive from the State Department actually came in saying that they would not let them leave. Glenn Beck talked a bit about this on his show The Blaze on Wednesday, and there were a few clips from that program played from on the Trumpet Daily Radio show earlier this week, where Beck was basically explaining that they were ready to leave, and they told them, the State Department told them they couldn't because some of the 143 people there hadn't been thoroughly vetted yet, which is a big change because they evacuated thousands of people earlier in the summer who weren't vetted at all, and Beck wasn't saying that he wanted to let them into the United States unvetted. He was just saying that he wanted to get them to a Western airport where they could be safely vetted, because he's reporting that actually one of those people have already died because of the delay. He didn't give too much details on the circumstance surrounding the death, but definitely attributing it that if the State Department would have let these people out, if they would have let these people out, that blood could have been, that death could have been avoided. Actually, Foreign Policy is reporting here, they're digging a little bit deeper into some of these delays, and they're saying that even though the directives are coming from the State Department, the State Department's refusing to let some of these people leave due to delays in their negotiations with the Taliban. And this really shows why this is not just a bureaucratic delay, but a hostage crisis, because the Foreign Policy article was actually titled "Biden is running a hostage negotiation with the Taliban," and they're basically saying that the Taliban wants America to recognize them as the legitimate government of Afghanistan. Once America does that, it makes it easier for them to get some money and foreign aid, and other things that the Taliban wants. But as part of that process, to be recognized as the legitimate government of America, it basically means that America would have to remove the Taliban from its official list of terrorist organizations. So far, America has refused to do that, and that's contributing to the delays of why they're not letting these people out of the airport. So you're now in a really sort of ironic, tragically ironic situation where the Taliban's basically holding 300 people hostage, saying that, like, well, until you say we're not terrorists, we're not letting these people leave the country.
Yeah, that is pretty ironic. We're not terrorists, and unless you acknowledge this fact, we're going to hold your people hostage.
Right, because there's other reports that they've actually even had pictures. I saw this morning of like Afghan journalists reporting on some of these things who have been held by the Taliban and tortured, and so this organization is literally torturing American friendly journalists and holding people hostages. And so another negotiating position is basically it's like say we're not terrorists or we'll kill the hostages, which it's kind of like a death to those who call us violent protest. It's they definitely make a big protest, but they're proving in a very dramatic way the very point they're trying to get the Western world to say isn't true. And yeah, probably. I mean, you could definitely make a case that this could end up being the worst hostage crisis in American history. I mean, one of the most high profile hostage crises America's ever dealt with was the Iranian hostage crisis after the Iranian Revolution. You had a dozen or so Americans trapped at the embassy in Tehran that the Iranians eventually released because Ronald Reagan was elected president. But even in that case, it's we weren't. The Carter administration was not negotiating with the Iranian government in the same way that the Biden administration is negotiating with the Taliban. I mean, because it actually looks like that could be on the table, that as the Biden administration pivots to trying to fight ISIS-K and use the Taliban as their partner, that they may end up recognizing the Taliban as the legitimate government and saying they're not terrorists and just throwing our Afghan allies under the bus and allowing these journalists to continue to be tortured if that's what it takes to get these remaining Americans out of the country. The article we can put in the show notes is our most recent one from our editor-in-chief. This isn't incompetence, this is treason. That really goes through a number of Bible prophecies in Daniel 11 and Revelation 12 about Satan being cast to the earth, and showing that just his influence in the government has reached a level where the Biden administration, it's not that this hostage crisis isn't happening because the U.S. government is run by the Three Stooges or something like that, although you could be forgiven for thinking that, but this is a deliberate attack to empower the Taliban, put them in place as a military superpower running the nation of Afghanistan, even if that means giving them billions of dollars of American weaponry paid for with taxpayer dollars, and like I said, really betraying these journalists that are being tortured and these Christian Americans and Afghans who are still sitting someplace in Afghanistan, just waiting for the State Department to actually give the order for a private organization like Glenn Beck's to do the hard work of getting them out of the country.
Well, that article by Gerald Fleury certainly is a blockbuster. This isn't incompetence. This is treason. It points back to so much of what Gerald Fleury was saying years ago about the Obama administration and just how much satanic influence there is in that administration. And we're seeing it alive today as well. And we appreciate you bringing that to us very much, Andrew. Thank you for that. What is going to happen to that massive airbase the U.S. left behind at Bagram? Well, the Chinese are considering some options. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the Bagram airfield is probably the single most prominent symbol of America's 20-year military presence in Afghanistan. This base is just an hour from Kabul, the capital, and it functioned as the main hub of U.S. operations in the country for all of this time. And now, as you said, the Chinese have designs on it. They appear to be on the cusp of convincing the Taliban to let China take over this airfield. So we've spoken on the show a few times in recent weeks about China's very high-profile outreach to the Taliban. Even before the U.S. had withdrawn, China saw the writing on the wall, and the Chinese started preparing to really embrace the Taliban as the rightful, legitimate rulers of Afghanistan. Weeks before Kabul fell, China hosted a Taliban delegation in Beijing, and that really was a landmark meeting. And it was laying the groundwork for China to build a very meaningful partnership with these terrorists. And initially, there were not really many details known about what this partnership might entail. But a new report by U.S. News is now giving us a view of what it's about. This report shows that China's military is now conducting feasibility studies about sending soldiers and other military personnel into Bagram airfield with the goal of basically turning it into a Chinese base. So we know that China has already been funding the Taliban. The Chinese foreign ministry said just yesterday that China is giving them $31 million worth of food and COVID vaccines, and that'll be just the start. And then in exchange for that, the Taliban has apparently signed on to a couple of major agreements. One is not to let Afghanistan become a staging ground for Uyghur Muslims that live in China to conduct, you know, whatever attacks they would like to conduct in China. And then another is not to let any of China's infrastructure in Afghanistan or Pakistan be hit by terrorist attacks. And now we can add to that list the possibility of letting China take over the Bagram airfield, which would just greatly expand China's influence in Afghanistan and really across the whole region in a major way. So basically what we're seeing here is the Taliban getting vast amounts of Chinese cash and diplomatic support from the incredibly powerful Chinese government. And in exchange, China looks like it is getting a new satellite state.
Well, this really is consistent with the kinds of moves that China has been making in several theaters. Maybe you could just put it in the context of how it's expanding its military power more generally.
Sure, yeah. There has been a pattern over the years of China just quietly expanding its military influence well beyond its borders. And it often happens under the guise of infrastructure investment projects. And sometimes it even happens in areas that were previously under U.S. control. So we've seen that very recently at the Ream Naval Base in Cambodia. That was a U.S.-built base, and it was a country that America had invested many millions into. But now the Chinese are moving into the very base that America had built there, and they're establishing what I think is just an invaluable naval presence at a key location on Cambodia's coast. We've also seen China building overseas military hubs in Myanmar and Djibouti there in Africa. So China really is expanding far beyond its borders, the South China Sea as well. And now it looks like we could soon add Afghanistan to this list, and likely even the Bagram Air Base, which was a major symbol of U.S. power in that area. So just a very significant victory for China, and it adds even more to the embarrassment and humiliation for the United States.
Yeah, it is pretty remarkable to think of all of that investment that America made in that base. And as you said, it's probably the most prominent symbol of that 20-year war that America waged over there, for that to fall into the hands of the Chinese, which many people are viewing as America's number one enemy in the world today, or it's just quite an extraordinary picture of the change in this American-led era to the times of the Gentiles.
Yes. Yeah, I think this is just a pretty stark picture of a big shift in the global power balance, because for decades, there was leadership provided by the United States and the UK, and that was, on the whole, a force of stabilization for much of the world. They advanced civilization and they improved life for many people all around the globe. But now that Anglo-American age is ending and the world is moving into a new era, and it's one that, as you said, the Bible calls it the times of the Gentiles. Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury wrote all about this new era in our February 2020 issue. This is in an article called The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man. And in one section of it, he writes, quote, "When this prophecy is completely fulfilled, there will be two main powers, one revolving around Russia and China, and the other around Germany." And then a little further down, he writes, "These times of the Gentiles are yet to be fully realized. However, we are in the outer edges of this catastrophic storm." So that was back in early 2020 that he wrote that article, some 18 months ago. And I think we could now say, especially in light of the Afghanistan situation and just how it has diminished U.S. power and how it has set the stage to really expand Chinese power especially, I think we can say that we're even deeper into the outer edges of that catastrophic storm.
The article that you mentioned, The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man, is that correct?
That's right, yep.
Well, we'll link to that in the show notes for today's program. Thank you very much for that, Jeremiah. Lawmakers in Washington want to extend an exclusive intelligence relationship to several countries, including Germany. For this story, we'll go to Richard Palmer.
Yes, so the Subcommittee on Intelligence and Special Operations in Congress, which is under the House Armed Services Committee, they put together a draft of the National Defense Authorization Act for the 2022 fiscal year. And this draft contains a rather fascinating piece of information that was put in there. So that revolves around this Five Eyes Alliance. So the Five Eyes Alliance is quite possibly the closest alliance that the United States possesses. Obviously, NATO is a very close alliance where an attack on any NATO member is to be considered an attack on the United States. And America has lent nuclear weapons out to several NATO countries. So that's a pretty intense alliance. The Five Eyes is one step further, though, where these countries just share a whole lot of intelligence. It was formed initially kind of in 1946. And the Five Eyes are, you know, the United States, the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. Five countries that are pretty similar politically. The Western world, obviously, when we're looking at it through the prophetic lens, this is an alliance of the countries that are the descendants of modern Israel, that are the primary recipients of God's blessings to Abraham. And you can read more in our free book on that, on the United States and Britain and prophecy. But this subcommittee wants to add some more countries to the Five Eyes Alliance. They want to add Germany, Japan, South Korea, and India, or at least they want to begin looking into adding these four. Now, Japan, there's been a fair bit of talk over the last little while, over the last really couple of years probably, about adding them to the Five Eyes Alliance. They're seen as kind of being one of the most capable opponents of China. Bringing them in to the Five Eyes Alliance is seen as kind of a way to stand up for China. Germany is much newer. There hasn't been as much discussion on bringing Germany into that relationship. But now this committee, I mean, it's in the early stages. It's a draft bill. But the ball is getting in motion now to start looking at inviting Germany into that relationship.
And what is it about Germany in particular that catches your eye as you look at this story?
Well, there's a couple of things. We actually have an article up on the website right now, Will Germany Join the Five Eyes? And one of the points that this makes that I think is really good is this is pretty eye-catching and concerning just from a world news standpoint. You know, the justification given for expanding the Five Eyes is to stand up to China and potentially as well Russia. But then you look at Germany's relationship with Russia, one of America's top adversaries, and that would raise some serious questions about inviting them in to the Five Eyes Alliance. You know, as this article points out, they've just kind of jumped in bed with Russia with the Nord Stream natural gas pipeline that directly ties them to Russia. Like we talked about on the show a week or two ago, Chancellor Merkel just kind of went over to visit with Vladimir Putin. And in that meeting, Putin really sent a clear message inviting Germany in to a special relationship. So, you know, Germany is at the very least flirting with Russia. And then to invite them into the Five Eyes alliance, this kind of ultra secure alliance that would grant them access to all of Germany's intelligence, you know, they would have the potential there for them to just to turn around and hand things over to Russia, is absolutely massive. So from that point of view alone, I think people should be answering some serious questions, asking some serious questions. Then you get into just the historical and prophetic aspects of this story. And here I'd just like to point our readers to an article that Trumpet editor-in-chief wrote all the way back in 1999, Alamogordo, A Mistake You Only Make Once. And this is about when America was trusting Germany with an Air Force base in U.S. territory. Now, that Air Force base has now closed, but inviting Germany into the Five Eyes alliance would be a level of trust exponentially higher than just allowing them to have an Air Force base. You know, this is opening them up, opening all of American intelligence up to Germany. And what that article does is it sounds a warning from history. It talks about times in the past where Germany has double-crossed nations. There's some just fantastic quotes from Winston Churchill, who was warning that even in the run-up to World War One, and then, of course, World War Two as well, of the German potential for a dramatic double cross. And then that article goes through the Bible prophecy as well, and that there's a lot of Bible prophecy, too, that tells us that you're going to see Britain and America, these Israelite nations, these same nations that are in the Five Eyes alliance, we're going to see them turn to Germany, trust Germany, and that trust is going to be betrayed. And you know, who knows exactly how far this bill will go, whether it will, whether they'll be invited in, whether they'd even accept the invite. But the fact that Congress is willing to say we need to look into extending an invite to Germany shows how much the United States trusts Germany. It shows that relationship that is talked about in the Bible, that lover's relationship, is there already. It will probably just intensify, but we see that there, and the Bible says that Germany is going to betray that relationship, and the opportunity for betrayal as part of the Five Eyes alliance is pretty terrifying.
Yeah, kind of inherent in that prophecy is just the naivety on the part of Americans in trusting someone who really is has shown themselves not to be a reliable ally, and given everything that has taken place, just the kind of rocky relationship that has existed between Germany and America in recent years, it is quite extraordinary. And those other countries that you mentioned as well, it just seems like these lawmakers are demonstrating that kind of puzzling naivety that you see reflected in that prophecy.
Right, and that is a good point about those other countries too. I mean, Germany is the one the Bible focuses on, but yeah, I mean, America's trust of Japan as well is, I mean, these are both, it is just interesting the way that we're inviting in these two countries that were the main adversaries in World War II. And then, yeah, you look at the rise of Japanese politicians going to lay down, you know, going visiting shrines of the leaders that fought in World War II, the way that they're, I mean, Jeremiah's talked about this a few times, the way that their textbooks kind of glorify their World War II leaders. I mean, geopolitics and the kind of the balance of power does put them on America's side to a certain extent with China. But you look at the thinking that's there, and trusting Japan in the long run would be foolish as well.
Well, that we will link to that article, Alamogordo, A Mistake You Only Make Once, in the show notes. We also have this article that's going up on the website, Could Germany Join Five Eyes, as well as the United States and Britain in Prophecy, that points to this and other really alarming prophecies about what is going to happen to America in the end time. And this really does demonstrate the relevance of those prophecies. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Iran has a new president and a new government, and anyone hoping that the nation would be growing more moderate in light of the Biden administration's pro-Iranian policies is going to be sorely disappointed. For this story, we'll turn to Joshua Taylor.
According to an Iranian expert to a press group organized by Jerusalem-based Media Center, the Shiite cleric Ibrahim Raisi, the new president, is being groomed to replace the aging Ayatollah Khomeini as the supreme leader of the regime in the near future. And to increase his credentials for that job, the regime has ensured he will become the president. Raisi has spent his entire life serving in the Iranian judiciary. At the age of 20, Raisi became the prosecutor general in his small town where he grew up. There, he started using what would become a hallmark of his judiciary style, execution. In one case, during his early career, he executed 4 women and 10 men for prostitution and possession of illegal drugs. In 1988, Raisi earned the title the Butcher of Tehran as the capital city's prosecutor general. Over the course of 5 months, Raisi helped in executing thousands of political prisoners in Iranian prisons. The number of murdered Iranians remains unknown. Human rights organizations place the number of executed men, women, and children between 4,500 to 5,000, and that's the conservative estimate. According to some Iranian defectors, that number could be well over 30,000. As the president, Ibrahim Raisi has wasted absolutely no time. He has assembled an impressive list of Ayatollah-approved hardliners, terrorists, and radicals for his administration. All of them have either served the IRGC in the past or have served on previous administrations. And one of those most prominent is Iran's new foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian. Abdollahian is an experienced diplomat, has served many posts throughout his time, including the Minister of Arab and Foreign Affairs, and is in that post that he gained a foothold in the Iranian political community. There, he became good friends with Qassem Soleimani, the former IRGC elite Quds Force general. In an interview with the regional editor of Tehran Foreign Policy Studies Quarterly, Abdollahian said he knew Soleimani closely. He also praised Soleimani and called him a commander of peace and believed Soleimani's role in strengthening peace and security in the region and the world was very unique. According to the Fars News Agency, the mouthpiece for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, Abdollahian declared he would continue the path of Soleimani after he was assassinated in January 2020. It isn't only the IRGC that favors Abdollahian. Iran's supreme leader also favors him. He has published over 10 analytical pieces on the Ayatollah's own website. Two other prominent members in the Iranian government is the Interior Minister Ahmad Vahidi and the Economics Minister Moshe Raisi. Both of these men are currently under U.S. sanctions and wanted by Interpol for their respective roles in a bombing in the 1994 Association Mutual Israelita Argentina bombing that killed 85 and wounded about 250. Both are wanted by Interpol under what's called a red notice. Both Vahidi and Raisi have been members of the IRGC and have featured prominently either as leaders of the IRGC themselves or of the elite Quds force.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that the Ayatollah is putting these kind of people in power because for the longest time, Iran has really tried to present a moderate face to the West. They've put people in power who could, you know, pass for moderates. This seems like the time for that is past. And you just have to wonder how much of this is, you know, basically they were able to outlast Trump. Netanyahu is gone from Israel. They have leaders in power that are much more favorable, much less likely to respond with toughness to Iran taking these kinds of moves. It's hard not to see this as really a direct response to what's happening politically in these other countries.
Yes. Iran now has the capability to enrich uranium up to 60%, and Defense Minister Benny Gantz of Israel said that Iran is possibly within 2 months of attaining the nuclear bomb. So you can see by the Ayatollahs and this new government's appointees, they're done playing games. They're done playing to the U.S.'s and the Western allies' tune. They no longer need to play nice. And now with that, the bomb is within Iran's reach. They're dispensing with the sheep's clothing altogether.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very, very interesting to see this taking place politically in Iran. The people of Iran who have protested against the radicalism of the ruling class there, they have been silenced very effectively. The Ayatollah seems to be working really with impunity in the geopolitical climate that has been created in these recent months. And so it seems like Iran has definitely taken its course that is very much in line with what we expect prophetically.
Yes, as Iran continues to move towards a nuclear bomb, they're going to just continue to be emboldened. They're going to continue to push at the other nations of the world. And the interesting thing is there is one nation that is watching them very closely, and that is the nation of Germany. Germany expressed grave concern for their advances towards the nuclear bomb, and especially with what's happening in Afghanistan and the potential for immigrants to come up towards Germany because of the issues there. As Iran gets more and more powerful, Germany is going to become more and more wary of that, and especially as we see them neglecting and deciding not to come back to the negotiation table.
Well, Josh has written an article that should appear on Watch Jerusalem very closely, the sister site to thetrumpet.com. The title of that article, Iran's New Radical Islamist Government. I'm sure we'll get a version of that up at thetrumpet.com soon, but we'll try to link to that in the show notes if we can. We thank you very much for that. In the meantime, you can read our booklet, The King of the South, written by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry, that explains Iran's role in Bible prophecy. Thank you very much for that, Joshua. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we'll look at the phenomenally authoritarian COVID restrictions in Australia. Also, Russia preparing for more severe energy attacks on Europe. Russia and other nations responding to the security situation in Afghanistan with military exercises. And the armaments that America abandoned in Afghanistan ending up in the hands of Iran. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
The means by which Australia is trying to address coronavirus has taken extraordinarily authoritarian turns. For this story, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, this is quite an amazing story. I mean, there's plenty of people here in the United States getting fed up with mask mandates and social distancing and coronavirus lockdowns, but Australia, just the measures the government's taken there are really an order of magnitude worse than even it is here. There's an article written for the National Review this week by Rich Lowry entitled, "Australia's Insane COVID Rules Are a Warning to the Rest of the Free World." And he has a pretty powerful statement right there at the beginning of the article where he writes, "Once an honorable member of the free world, Australia has lurched into a bizarre and disturbing netherworld of bureaucratic oppression in the name of public health. Australia's lockdown mania has been so all-consuming that one assumes much of it would make Anthony Fauci blush." And so they're just making the comparison that as fed up with as people are with Dr. Fauci here, even he would presumably be kind of disturbed at just the extent that Australia's gone to. I think 60% of the country is in lockdown. And when I say lockdown, it's not like it is here where like some restaurants closed, where they've actually, some cities have even have people like with an app on their phone where like the government can at random reach out to you and ask you to provide proof within 15 minutes that you haven't left your house. And so like at any moment, it's like, I think those same cities, they'll give you maybe like 2 hours a day where you can leave to do something. But for like 22 out of the 24 hours of the day, you have to be at home, and the government can reach out to you anytime and ask for documentation that you're at home. I mean, the travel ban there is like I said, it's almost impossible to leave the country. And many cities have like an official curfew, kind of like you'd seen in movies here for like World War II, where like after a certain hour, you've got to be back home. You've got official curfews. I've even heard reports of like they're putting rations on like beer and wine because you have to take your mask off to drink those type of things, usually in a social situation. This is a quote from one of the chief health officer in the state of New South Wales who actually said, "Whilst it is human nature to engage in conversation with others and to be friendly, unfortunately, this is not the time to do that." And so, basically, telling people like even discouraging, like you really shouldn't even be talking to each other because that encourages you to take your mask off, because if you've ever had a conversation in one of those masks, it's kind of hard to hear the other person. So this is just the insane levels that this country's gone to stop a pandemic, which it's good to remind people from the onset, like if you take the average over the past several months is killing about 1.5 people a week.
Right. Yeah, that's the truly extraordinary thing about this is that the level of threat that Australia is facing is so low, especially compared to so many other nations, and the measures that they're taking that are just absolutely trashing the freedoms of the citizenry they're being taken with such a low bar of the danger that this poses. I think anybody looking at this situation has to just marvel that Australians are going this far, this fast over something so minor.
Right, right. And the point that that Rich Lowry was making in the article, that's like said, really, this is a warning to the free world. I mean, he's even made the point, which is like really reasonable. It's like they're acting like a communist state or like something that like from a George Orwell novel, to a level that's really calling into question whether Australia can even honestly be called a liberal democracy anymore. And that's a huge curse for Australia, but there's other Western countries. I mean, the United States and Britain and Canada haven't gone to as insane measures, but are definitely still using trampling the rule of law and constitutional rights to try to allegedly combat a disease that's not much worse than the flu. One of the articles we can put in the show notes is by our executive editor, Mr. Stephen Fleury, titled "The Cure is Killing Us," that focuses a little bit more on efforts in the United States, but really tying it back to some of those scriptures I actually mentioned in the first half, like in Revelation 12 about Satan being cast down and really focusing on that's really the only explanation for why a nation would take this draconian of a steps for really no reason at all. This isn't a case of like, okay, well, we've got to like subvert some of our constitutional freedoms to prevent a really horrible crisis, because it's a pretty mild crisis. And so you're subverting these freedoms for no reason, and it's you can definitely see that same spiritual dimension behind it, like you see in the Afghan hostage crisis, where you're just making all these horrible decisions for no reason other than to destroy the country.
Yeah, this also reminds me of the article that Josue Michels wrote in the new print edition of The Trumpet. It's called "Death of the U.S., Death of Freedom." And he just talks about the fact that you have this abandonment of the principles of freedom in a place that has been such a bastion of those principles. And Australia is very much in the same camp, the way that the Australians have upheld these values of freedom for so long. And he just, in that article, it talks about the rise in authoritarian tendencies that's happening globally, and it's manifesting itself in a lot of different areas. There's the COVID restrictions and so on. You also have issues like the way that governments are trying to restrict the free flow of cash. They want to have more control over economic activity. And it's taking place, obviously, in nations like China and the communist Chinese Communist Party in Russia. But the fact that it's also happening in nations like Australia is really extraordinary. And it reflects this global trend that we see taking place that is very, very concerning and really does is consistent with what the Bible has said about what we should expect in the final days of this age of man. Well, we will link to that article, The Cure is Killing Us, in the show notes, and also that Death of the U.S., Death of Freedom article by Josue Michels. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. Russia has often used energy as a weapon against other nations. Well, now it's gaining even more capability to do that. To learn about this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, just a few weeks ago, Russia and Germany completed their Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline. This pipeline that will allow Russia to continue to supply Western Europe and their profitable customers while cutting off and blackmailing Eastern Europe. What we've also been seeing at the same time over the summer, and something that's very disturbing, is Russia getting ready to use this weapon. So typically, over the summer, states will get in more gas than they need from Russia and elsewhere and store it to try and make sure they've got enough for the winter. Or at least, you know, it's hard to store enough to get you all the way through the winter, but at least you've got a buffer. If things go wrong, you've maybe got 2 weeks supply on hand or something like that. However, there have been some energy problems and disruption in the energy market anyway. And now Russia is deliberately not sending in enough gas into Europe for people to refill their reserves. So Ambrose Evans-Pritchard wrote about this at the Telegraph. This week he wrote that Russia's Vladimir Putin is orchestrating a deliberate energy supply crisis in Europe by restricting the seasonal flow of pipeline gas. He talked about how even the UK could potentially face serious shortages and maybe even rationing over the winter. I mean, we have our own sources of natural gas in the North Sea, but that's still not enough to cover everything that we use it for, especially as so much of Europe is switching away from coal and towards gas. He talks about how Gazprom is effectively working to rule, delivering the obligatory contract volumes, but not the seasonal top-up flows needed to replenish stocks. He wrote, President Putin has already secured much of what he wants in a deal with Germany and the U.S., denounced by its critics as a latter-day Yalta, talking about the agreement that divided up Europe at the end of World War II. This pipeline has also been compared to the pact that Hitler and Stalin signed to divide Europe up between them. The agreement, writes Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, abandons Ukraine to its fate, notwithstanding a pro forma pledge by the Western allies. That the Kremlin will not be allowed to weaponize energy flows once Nord Stream 2 begins to flow. Mr. Putin is testing the credibility of this, going in for the kill. You know, that's what this is doing right now, going in for the kill, preparing to be able to blackmail some of these countries when the supplies are most needed, you know, when cutting off natural gas isn't just an inconvenience, but means people unable to heat their homes in the middle of a Ukrainian or Polish winter, you know, people dying. So there's the potential here for a pretty serious gas crisis being set up now over the winter.
Well, this is really exactly what caused so much concern with that Nord Stream 2 project, the fact that it gives Russia this kind of power. These preparations that you're talking about really suggest our worst fears were justified, and really the Eastern European nations that would be most affected by this are extremely concerned to see this happening, given the power that this gives Russia over them.
Yes, they are. I mean, Ukraine has been very vocal on how they feel like they've been thrown under the bus here, where you know they know the value of a piece of paper signed by America and Germany saying we promise we'll protect Ukraine. You know, that value is nothing. America signed a piece of paper 20, 30 years ago, the Budapest Memorandum, promising to protect Ukraine's territorial integrity. That turned out to be absolutely worthless when Russia invaded Crimea. So they're worried about this. But yes, the NATO members as well, the European Union members, Poland and Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, some of these countries are also very worried about this. You know, Poland has been trying to work on its own alternative pipeline to get gas from Norway so it's not dependent upon Russia. So they see what this means. The Poles have been very public in kind of comparing this to Hitler and Stalin. And it's causing a lot of movement within Eastern Europe and a lot of increases in defense spending and this kind of thing, too.
So looking at this prophetically, the relationship between Russia and these Eastern European countries and really Europe even more generally, why is this important for us to keep our eyes on?
So we have a booklet from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry titled The Prophesied Prince of Russia. And he talks about the role that Vladimir Putin and Russia plays in Bible prophecy in this booklet. And it's a tremendously important role. And one of those roles is something that prompts Europe to return to being a military power, something that we're seeing that we talked about on this show last week, that something that we see accelerating after Afghanistan, where they see they can't rely on America to protect them. And then they see they live in this world of dangers. Mr. Flurry wrote all the way back in August 2008 that you had this Georgia crisis then, and he wrote, will this strike actually spark European unification? What if a crisis occurs over Ukraine? That area is the breadbasket of Russia, and it's surely willing to wage war over that as well. And he talked about how Russia's activities could really prompt Europe to unite military. And even in Germany, where they're kind of making these deals with Russia, I think they know that there's a risk here. They know that an empowered Russia can be a threat to them. So as Russia becomes more aggressive, then you know, we're going to see Europe unite. Their militaries come together so that they can stand up to Russia. They increase their military capacity. Exactly what we were talking about on the program last week in terms of all of these key prophecies about this military power that's going to arise in Europe and play such a dominant role in Bible prophecy.
The prophesied prince of Russia, we will link to that in the show notes for today's program. Thank you for that, Richard. The unstable security situation in Afghanistan has Russia and its military partners gearing up to intervene in some military exercises that happened this week. To learn about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Russia's central military district mobilized forces to Kyrgyzstan earlier this week to lead a set of military exercises that bring forces together from Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Kazakhstan. So this is happening under the banner of the Collective Security Treaty Organization, or the CSTO. That's one of Russia's most important alliance groups, and it's made up of mainly Central Asian nations, several of which share a border with Afghanistan. And Russia has said that these drills are in direct response to the situation in Afghanistan. So Russia and other CSTO members are concerned about security threats emanating from the really war-torn country. They're worried about the potential for tens of thousands of refugees to pour over the border there. And these joint military exercises are focused mainly on training soldiers to neutralize illegal armed groups that unlawfully enter any CSTO member state's territory. So it's clear that Russia and its allies in the Collective Security Treaty Organization are taking these threats very seriously, and Russia may well see it also as an opening to assert more power in Afghanistan and elsewhere in Central Asia.
This isn't the only military exercises that Russia is holding that are basically a response to what they see happening in Afghanistan.
That's right. Last month, Russia held two separate joint military exercises with Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. Those were both near the Afghan border. And then Russia also held some notable drills with China inside a part of China that was selected because of its desert and high plateau and climate, which are very much like many parts of Afghanistan. And then we also saw Russia and China hold a separate set of drills last month under the banner of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Those were with the militaries of several Central Asian nations as well. So it's just a pretty considerable uptick in these kinds of exercises. There is real concern about Afghanistan that's prompting a lot of it, but Russia and China also see openings here after the U.S. withdrawal. They see a chance to pull their allies in Central Asia more tightly under their control. That's one of the big results of holding so many joint military drills with them. And then they also see an opportunity to assert more of their own power just over this important region.
Well, Jeremiah wrote an article that appears in our new print edition, the special edition that we've devoted entirely to what is happening there in Afghanistan. The title of that article, Why Russia and China Are Rejoicing. Go check that out at thetrumpet.com. We'll link to it in the show notes. And we thank you very much for keeping your eye on that situation for us, Jeremiah. One final story. America left a whole lot of armaments behind when it hastily fled from Afghanistan. And some of these are ending up in the hands of Iran. For this story, we'll go back to Joshua Taylor.
Yes. So images on Iranian TV and other images that have surfaced on social media have shown a convoy of U.S. military equipment making its way to Tehran on one of their main roads coming off from Afghanistan. The convoy showed American Humvees and mine-resistant ambush-protected vehicles. They're a light armored vehicle being transported on the back of flatbed trucks heading toward the capital on the Semnan-Garmeshur Road. The social media channel that first broke this story also showed images, other images, that showed that channel specializes in Iranian military affairs. And it also claimed that the Iranians also had received or purchased American tanks, though that report has not been confirmed. According to a Russian news source, Iran has allegedly bought this equipment directly from the Taliban. Other reports say that Afghan military personnel fleeing the Taliban have also surrendered that military equipment. And the Iranians may have also purchased UAVs and U.S. Black Hawk helicopters from the Taliban as well. Most likely, this equipment will be taken to Iranian research centers and be reverse engineered just like they did with a downed U.S. drone back in December of 2011.
Well, this is quite unsurprising in a way. There were a lot of people who said that they would never see collusion taking place between the Taliban and Iran, but there was a lot of evidence to show that collusion has been taking place for some time. Brent Nachtigall has been writing about this. He has an article even in that new print edition of The Trumpet talking about how the Taliban and Iran have been colluding for quite some time. And when you look at the pro-Iranian policies coming out of the Biden administration, in some ways, this $85 billion armaments windfall that the United States left to the Taliban, they had to have known that this would have ended up in Iranian hands at some point. There's also talk about this ending up in the hands of China and other entities that have been active in Afghanistan since America's withdrawal. It's just a whole dimension to the disaster that has taken place with America's hasty exit from Afghanistan that is probably going to be, the ramifications are going to be playing out for some years to come.
Yes, the loss of the American military hardware to Iran is just a further embarrassment to the U.S. after the Afghanistan withdrawal, and with the way Iran is arming itself and growing in power in the region, this will just continue to embolden them, to cause them to grow more powerful in terms of their military, and grant them a much greater advantage over its neighbors in even just conventional military hardware, especially if they did get those American tanks. A spokesman from the United States Pentagon said that all this equipment, if it is true that it's going to Iran, is meant to fight low-tech forces. But as we, again, as these reports show, that's just not the case. This military hardware is quite advanced and will do nothing but just increase Iran's power.
Yeah, it's I guess Anthony Blinken and some other U.S. officials have been saying that this hardware doesn't really pose much of a threat to America. It doesn't pose a threat to Afghanistan's neighbors. It's difficult to foresee how the Taliban would be able to even make use of some of these things. But you get more sophisticated militaries involved, and like you said, for the Iranians to get hold of some of these, some of this hardware, and to be able to not just use it, but to reverse engineer it and to steal the technology, China has certainly done that quite a lot in the past as well. It's not just a matter of what we left behind, the specific numbers of the equipment. It's also the technology itself that the United States created at great expense over a period of decades, military research and development that has gone into that, creating that material and that technology, that is escaping into hands that we really have, it really works against America's interests. Well, the article that Brent wrote for the newest print edition is called "With Enemies Like These, Who Needs Friends?" You can check that out by looking at that new print edition of the Trumpet magazine. We'll link to it in the show notes for the program today. Thank you for that, Joshua. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Joshua Taylor, and Richard Palmer. And thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Edmund Burke: "Nobody made a greater mistake than he who did nothing, because he could only do a little." Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.